this goes on, the more damage there could be.
The government shutdown continues, and the Affordable Care Act is still at the center of the fight.
Open enrollment begins in days, so what happens next?
For Thursday, October 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. When companies need loans, they normally turn to banks.
But in the past 15 years, the private credit market has exploded, now valued around $2 trillion.
The challenge is, where is private credit ultimately getting the dollars that are coming its way to invest?
And later, our science news roundup from NPR's science podcast, Shortwave.
Hear why more pixels on your HD TV might not make a difference.
The number of pixels doesn't mean a lot, but the viewing distance and also how large the screen is. So what matters is how many pixels are packed in a per unit area.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A slim majority of the GOP-led Senate voted to end President Trump's emergency tariff program. But the Republican-led House isn't expected to take up the effort. NPR's Claudia Grisales has more.
The series of three votes this week amounted to a test for Senate Republicans divided over the president's emergency tariffs in Brazil, Canada, and around the globe. Despite passage, the resolutions are not expected to get a vote in the House. Speaker Mike Johnson earlier this year installed a rules change to block resolutions challenging the president's tariffs authority from reaching the House floor. Even so, President Trump would veto the measure if it reached his desk. Earlier this week, Vice President J.D. Vance lobbied Republican senators to vote no, but a handful were not convinced. Kentucky's Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, Maine's Susan Collins, and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski defected to vote with Democrats. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
Today's the 30th day of the federal government shutdown, and lawmakers are no closer to negotiating a short-term funding bill that would reopen it and fund programs. More than a million federal workers are furloughed, with some required to work. Neither group is being paid. Among them, air traffic controllers. Vice President Vance.
I think that as much as delays have gotten worse over the last couple of weeks, everybody here is very worried that we're going to see more delays, more stresses on the people who are actually making the aviation system run.
Meanwhile, food assistance through the SNAP program expires on Saturday for the nearly 42 million Americans who get the help. Senate Democrats want Republicans to extend health care subsidies that are scheduled to run out at the end of the year, likely resulting in much higher bills for tens of millions of people. The Trump administration is drastically cutting the number of refugees it will admit to the U.S., capping it at 7,500 for the next year. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports that's the lowest level on record.
In a notification in the Federal Registry, President Trump has capped the refugee admissions for the next fiscal year at 7,500, and he says most of those spots will be set aside for white South Africans, who he says are the victims of, quote, unjust racial discrimination. It makes no mention of Afghans, despite past promises to help those who supported the U.S. in America's longest war. Afghan Evac, a group that advocates for bringing those Afghan allies here, says tens of thousands remain in danger abroad, and this new policy gives them no safe pathway to the U.S. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell. The Dow down 109 points. NASDAQ down 377. That's down 1.5%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The British Parliament is taking rare action against a member of the royal family. In London, NPR's Lauren Freyer reports the ongoing fallout of Prince Andrew's controversial friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, 6 years after Epstein's death by suicide in a New York City jail.
Parliament's spending watchdog is asking the UK Treasury and the Crown Estate, which manages property owned by the royals, to explain why Prince Andrew is still living rent-free in a 30-room royal lodge on the grounds of Windsor Castle. The watchdog is giving them till the end of November to explain how the prince's living arrangements are, quote, achieving the best value for money for UK taxpayers. This month, in a posthumous memoir, one of Jeffrey Epstein's accusers said she had sex with the prince, too, when she was 17. Andrew denies it. Then this week, photos emerged of Andrew hosting Epstein and convicted rapist and former movie producer Harvey Weinstein together at the prince's daughter's 18th birthday. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Andrew recently relinquished some of his royal titles and honors. The average note for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage jumped 20 basis points this week after the Federal Reserve yesterday cut its benchmark interest rate. Mortgage buyer Freddie Mac says the average rate on a 30-year loan is now 6.3%. This is after Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell signaled that there might not be any more rate cuts this year. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Blue Moon, a new film directed by Richard Linklater, starring Ethan Hawke, Margaret Qualley, Bobby Cannavale, and Andrew Scott. Now playing everywhere. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The country is about a month into a government shutdown, with the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, still at the center of the fight. Democrats are still holding out for a deal to extend the tax credits that help people pay for health care through the ACA exchanges, warning that without those subsidies, health care costs would skyrocket for tens of millions of people. People like Lynn Chernin from Tampa, Florida.
I had emergency gallbladder surgery, and I got a bill from the hospital for $85,000.
She got that bill while she was still on a private insurance plan, and she later switched to an ACA plan she's really happy with.
It's significantly better. I mean, the premiums are great. The copays are amazing. You know, I feel very, very lucky.
Same goes for Chernin's friend and former colleague, Laura Reynolds, who also got on Obamacare this year.
Amazingly enough, it almost seems to cover better medication than my own insurance I was paying almost $1,000 a month for.
Yesterday, both women were able to get a look at their estimated costs for next year on the exchanges. And for Chernin,
my insurance premium would only be going up about $1 a month.
Reynolds, on the other hand, was shown an estimated premium of more than $450 a month. That is a huge jump because right now she has a $0 premium. But she says it's still doable in light of what she used to pay before Obamacare.
Because it's still less money than I was paying out of pocket through my own company that I was working for.
But there's still frustration for Reynolds, not due to costs, but the political fight over those costs. Her stepdaughter, a government worker, has been affected by the shutdown, a shutdown that persists as Democrats say they're fighting to keep health care more affordable for millions like her.
It is very upsetting that the one thing that is shutting our government down right now is the fact that they're arguing over health care. You know, when you're talking millions and millions of people who are on Marketplace, and then you have this small group of people who are determining our health and our future.
Cynthia Cox conducts research on the Affordable Care Act for KFF, a health information nonprofit, and she's here to break down where things stand. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I know that KFF's research leading up to this week estimated that on average, most Americans would see what they're paying for their ACA health insurance more than double. The exact number was a 114% jump again on average. Now, in the past day of quote-unquote window shopping, is there any reason to believe that most people won't really see huge jumps in what they pay? I know that we heard from one person in Florida who told us that their costs are really not going up by all that much.
So these premiums are really based on a formula. What someone pays is a certain percent of their income. Mm-hmm. So for the vast majority of people who get a tax credit, it's actually really easy to figure out how much more they're going to have to pay. So really our estimate holds true that what people will pay will more than double on average. Of course, that's going to vary from person to person. Some people may not see much of a premium increase. Other people could see astronomical premium increases. But really, you know, I think the reality is that on average, people's costs are going to double. There are some things that people can do to mitigate those costs. You know, there might be a way to switch a plan, for example, instead of getting a silver plan, someone might be able to get a bronze plan, which would have a lower premium, but it would have a much higher deductible. And so there certainly are trade-offs that people will have to consider.
Cynthia, I mean, it's unclear what will happen on Capitol Hill, but even if lawmakers do find a way to end the shutdown, they come up with another plan to extend Obamacare tax credits into next year. At this point, with no plan in place, is the damage sort of already done? Can people still hold out hope for some sort of deal to extend subsidies?
The longer this goes on, the more damage there could be. You know, what the concern is from an insurer's perspective is that people are logging on now and shopping for plans, and they're going to see these big premium increases, and that might be enough to scare them away. You know, that might be enough for them to just drop their health coverage. So that's what health insurers are concerned, that the healthier or younger people are going to be the ones that drop their coverage, and then they'll be left with a sicker average group of people who are signing up, meaning that their costs are higher in premiums have to go up even more. And also, you know, just from a perspective of, you know, if you want more people to have insurance, then you want them to have, you know, full information of what their plans are actually going to be, you know, how much their costs are going to be for next year. At the same time, though, there's still time for Congress to make a change if they do decide to extend the tax credits. Although people are able to shop right now, the tax credits do not actually expire until the end of the calendar year. So if Congress were to act before December 31st, then the enhanced tax credits could still go into effect in January.
So say you're a person who's out there beginning to shop for ACA marketplace insurance next year. What advice would you give them right now?
If it were me, I would honestly wait a few weeks to shop. There still is some possibility that there could be a deal made, and probably shopping over the Thanksgiving holiday is fine. You know, that should give you enough time to, you know, look at your options and sign up for coverage. It's probably a good idea to decide on what your health plan is going to be before December 15th so that you can lock that plan in to start January 1st. Usually that's when you have to make a decision for coverage that starts January 1st. But if you wait a couple more weeks, you should still have enough time to sign up. That being said, if you think you're going to need someone to help you through the process, like an insurance agent or broker or a health insurance navigator, then start trying to make that contact and those appointments now, because these folks are going to be very busy this year.
Cynthia Cox, Vice President and Director of the Program on the Affordable Care Act for the nonprofit KFF. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump's National Guard deployments are not random. The president's inner circle, and at times Trump himself, have talked explicitly and publicly about them for years. Experts worry that these deployments could fundamentally change the way the military is used on U.S. soil. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
Back in 2023, Stephen Miller went on the late Charlie Kirk's popular conservative podcast.
Joining us now is Stephen Miller. Stephen, we have a lot of questions, not a lot of time. I know you're
talk about his plan for tackling illegal immigration if Trump won another term as president. Miller was a senior advisor for Trump in his first term. On the podcast, Miller describes sweeping immigration raids and mass deportations.
And in terms of personnel, you go to the red state governors and you say, give us your National Guard. We will deputize them as immigration enforcement officers.
Miller doesn't specify how that would be legal. Under U.S. law, the military can't broadly be used for policing domestically. But he continues.
The Alabama National Guard is going to arrest illegal aliens in Alabama and the Virginia National Guard in Virginia.
For blue states who don't comply, he says, you simply send in the guard from a nearby red state. In recent months, the Trump administration has deployed National Guard troops to states against the wishes of their Democratic governors to protect federal immigration facilities and officers. Those deployments are tied up in court challenges. On the 2024 campaign trail, Trump talked repeatedly about his intent to carry out the largest deportation operation in American history. In an interview with Time magazine, Trump affirmed his commitment to Miller's plan to use the National Guard to help. When Trump was elected to another term, he made Miller his right-hand man on immigration.
Trump was deeply deferential to Stephen, and I think you've seen that with a vastly more empowered Stephen Miller in a second term.
Miles Taylor was chief of staff in the Department of Homeland Security during Trump's first term. He has since become a vocal critic of the president.
At the time, Trump wasn't talking about those things publicly.
But Taylor says plans for using the National Guard for immigration were talked about behind closed doors during the first administration.
I can remember in meetings with him in the Oval Office or on Air Force One or at the border, him starting to bring up this idea of using the United States military to solve the problem.
It wasn't something Trump just talked about. In 2017, the Associated Press reported on a DHS memo it obtained, outlining a draft proposal to use the National Guard to round up unauthorized immigrants throughout the U.S. At the time, the White House denied it, saying there was no such plan. Taylor says there very much was.
But it was much more specific than that. It was the invocation of the Insurrection Act to deputize the military to enforce domestic law, to basically become a domestic police force.
Trump invoking the Insurrection Act would legally allow for the military to act as police on U.S. soil, to carry out immigration enforcement, but possibly other enforcement too, according to legal experts. NPR contacted the White House for this story. Spokesperson Abigail Jackson said the administration is committed to restoring law and order. She also called Taylor a hack, but did not directly address NPR's question about deputizing the Guard for law enforcement. These ideas are also embedded in Project 2025, a conservative action plan written by the Heritage Foundation. Trump has incorporated many of its policies into his second administration. The report's architect is the head of the White House's Office of Management and Budget.
I mean, the subtext of Project 2025 is to take any and all steps at the executive level to go into cities and states to enact the priority, which is to root out illegal immigration.
Matt Dalek is a professor at the George Washington University who studies the American conservative movement.
So Project 2025 opens the door to the deployment of the National Guard in a place like Chicago without explicitly calling for it to be deployed.
Project 2025 only mentions the National Guard a handful of times. Dalek says that while the Trump administration has implemented many parts of the project, it's also gone farther.
Beyond what is explicitly recommended there, and has used its power very creatively and also, I think, quite lawlessly in ways that the project does not explicitly call for.
In recent weeks, Trump has been talking about the Insurrection Act a lot. Not just about immigration enforcement, though. Trump has talked about invoking it to send the National Guard and possibly other troops to quell violent crime and protests in places like Portland, Chicago, San Francisco. That has people like Miles Taylor particularly concerned.
And all of a sudden, we're not talking about immigration anymore. We're talking about sending in the United States military to go against American citizens.
Legal experts worry about what that could look like, especially with the 2026 midterm elections and the possibility that U.S. troops could be present as voters cast ballots. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about the dinner menu is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Now for your Daily Dose of Phenology.
On today's date, October 30th in the year 2012, I have a note saying that I have seen my last tussock moth caterpillar. Last? Not really. It turns out that the tussock moth, like the woolly bear caterpillar, is one of those caterpillars that can be active throughout the winter. The tussock moth it's a family of moths, and they're quite varied in their appearances, but the caterpillars all have a similar way of avoiding being eaten, and that is they are very hairy, much like the woolly bear caterpillar. The tussock moth is very hairy, but the tussock moth is usually yellow with a black stripe. Sometimes it's got these red tufts of hair. Sometimes it's got four or five little columns, very tight packed columns of hair right in the middle of its back. So the tussock moths are quite easily identified, a little bit unusual in their appearance. But if you are seeing a caterpillar walking around in the middle of winter, and I have seen them in just about every month, maybe not in January, but certainly in March and April and in obviously October and November, they still are active. They have some way of protecting themselves against freezing, and when the weather warms up, they get out and move about. So watch out. Maybe you'll see a tussock moth. If not today, perhaps later on this winter.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. It's time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. I'm joined by the show's two hosts, Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. Hey to both of you.
Hey.
Hey, Ailsa.
Hey. Okay, so you have brought us three science stories, as you always do, stories that caught your attention this week. Mm-hmm. What are they?
We have for you how spiders add decorations to their webs.
Ooh.
Plus, why more pixels on your HDTV might not make a difference.
And how different kinds of stories change your brain.
Ooh, okay. Let's take spider webs first, just in time for Halloween.
Yes, I want to talk about orb webs. That's the spider web that looks like a wheel with concentric circles of silk on the spokes.
Yes,
yeah,
I've seen these.
So
they're so beautiful. Pretty.
Yeah, and sometimes orb webs have these additional bits of silk called stabilimenta. Stabilimenta, which look like a zigzag of threads or a flattened disc decoration.
Oh, I think I have seen these right before I've walked into a spider web with my face. Why are spiders decorating like that?
Yeah, no one knows for sure. The stabilimenta do reflect a wide range of light, so there's an idea that they might help attract prey or deter predators, but it's a big debate among silk scientists.
Discussing about stabilimenta for silk scientists is like picking up an easy fight.
Even that word stabilimenta sounds so beautiful.
This is Gabriele Greco. He wanted to throw another idea into the debate ring. He's a physicist and lead author of a new paper in the journal PLOS ONE, and he wondered if the stabilimenta actually helps spiders locate their prey.
I mean, that would be ingenious. Why would they need help, though?
Well, spiders, many of them have low vision. They can't look across the web and see their prey. Instead, they rely on the web's vibrations to sense dinner.
So when a fly hits the web, the impact sends out waves in all directions, like a string of a guitar being strummed. And that lets the spider know where their dinner has landed. And Gabriele wanted to know if the decorations helped in any way with wave propagation.
That is fascinating. And how did he go about testing that?
His team ran simulations like modeled web vibrations with a computer and found that when vibrations moved perpendicular to the spokes of the simulated web, the stabilimenta didn't make a difference. But when the vibrations moved parallel to the spiral threads of the web, the decorations did help. So the presence of the stabilimenta allowed the wave to travel farther.
Mm-hmm. So they finally settled the debate.
No, they actually complicated the debate. Gabriele recognizes his study has limits. It's just a simulation, and real webs are much more complex. Outside researchers, including Xitang Zhang, an ecologist at Hubei University, noted the study lacks behavioral data from real spiders. So to figure out if there's some kind of mechanical purpose for the stabilimenta, Gabriele plans to do more research, both in the lab and in the field.
So cool. Okay, next up, tell me about the study about pixels on my TV?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a team from the
Did I buy the wrong TV?
We'll get there. Don't worry. So a team from the University of Cambridge in the UK decided to ask the question, like, how many pixels on your high definition TV or really any display is too many? So pixels being that smallest unit of a digital image, that tiny colorful square.
Yeah.
So researchers had 18 people look at images on an adjustable display to see if they could distinguish between different resolutions or level of detail. And what they determined is that there is a limit.
A limit? Wait, what does that mean? Like, are certain fancy TVs with a ton of pixels just not worth it?
So it depends. So keep in mind there's so many factors that matter here. So we talked to Maliha Ashraf about it, and she's a human vision researcher and lead author of the study published in the journal Nature Communications.
The number of pixels by itself doesn't mean a lot, but rather when you put it into context with the viewing distance and also how large the screen is. So what matters is pixel density.
Pixel density. That's pixels per square inch. So a 4K TV has 4,000 pixels in a line across the screen. But screens come in different sizes.
Yeah.
4,000 pixels could be packed into a 55-inch TV or a 70-inch TV. And that will affect your viewing experience. Hmm. So Ailsa, like, say your dad just bought a new 80-inch TV that is 8K. That's 8,000 pixels across the screen. But he watches it from 10 feet away in a big room. That means he paid too much. He does not need something that powerful.
My dad never wants to pay too much for anything, so he would be mad at this. I wonder if my TV, though, at my house in Los Angeles has too many pixels for me to notice.
Yeah, so this is what I was worried about. I just bought a 65-inch TV, and it's the most I've ever spent on a TV, and I was dying to know, did I waste money? I brought it up to Maliha and Rafael Montuk, one of the other co-authors. They ran my TV specs through their calculator. I sit about 7 feet away.
I would say that you are exactly where you should be in terms of viewing distance. So I think that was, you know, the perfect fit for your, you know, viewing environment.
Nice.
Validated.
Perfection. Good job, Gina.
So lesson here, don't just buy a super megapixel TV because it's the newest model or highest resolution yet. Talk to the people at the store. Tell them the viewing distance in your TV room and buy something that actually fits your needs.
Yeah.
And Elsa, if you're wondering like why computer scientists are so interested in TVs, we should note that this study was funded by Meta because those sorts of insights are also like really important for people who make like VR goggles, 3D images, this new generation of technology for our eyes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, for our third topic, storytelling and the brain, I feel like NPR would be very interested in this. Gina?
Yeah. So there's a new study out this month in the Journal of Neuroscience that suggests the way a story is told changes how the memory of that story forms in the human brain.
Okay. So explain this a little bit to me. You're saying that different versions of the same story might activate my brain in different ways?
Yes, exactly. Huh. And to figure that out, researchers put participants in MRI machines and told them stories while looking at their brains. So all the participants heard a story about going out to eat with a line that read,
"Once I was ready to go, I took an Uber to meet my friend at the restaurant."
That's Charles Ferris, a cognitive neuroscientist and one of the study authors. And he says from there, researchers changed the details. In some cases, they also told the stories with extra sensory details like,
"I noticed a scuff mark on my blue shoes as I walked down my staircase towards the front door."
Yeah, you can almost picture this story, right? Yeah. Like hearing those details.
Right.
And with this version of the story, researchers saw more connections between the hippocampus, that's an area important for memory, and the area of the brain related to sensory integration and language processing.
Okay, so that was the first version of this story. What was the second version?
The second version had more conceptual details instead. So like how the person was thinking or what they felt.
"I wanted to take my time getting ready because it was important to me to look nice for my friend."
So these details are more related to the emotional context, right? And in this telling of the story, researchers then saw more connections between the hippocampus and areas of the brain related to emotion and conceptual processing.
And what does it mean if memories are forming in different areas of the brain?
So we asked Charan Ranganath, a neuroscientist at the University of California, Davis, and he didn't work on this paper, but he does study memory. And he says the study offers two big takeaways. First, how interconnected the human brain actually is.
The standard narrative in neuroscience has always been focused on single brain areas. And something that these authors are showing is that, in fact, memory is this kind of richly orchestrated set of interactions across these brain regions.
And secondly, he says this study emphasized that even if the key details of a story are the same, different ways of presenting that information could change the way a person processes it and possibly remembers it.
Yeah. Okay. Note to self.
Mm-hmm.
Storytellers, that's Emily Kwong and Regina Barber from NPR's science podcast Shortwave. Subscribe now for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
A small town in Michigan is debating whether to allow data centers. They're key to the growth of AI, but the machines need a lot of water to stay cool.
We all know that we can't live for 7 days without drinkable water.
How communities are resisting the AI boom and how the tech industry is responding. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji. Since 2009, Boreal Brushworks has provided full-service interior and exterior painting services throughout northern Minnesota. More information about estimates and services available at borealbrushworkspainting.com. And we receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. And taking a look at weather tonight, chance of rain, cloudy with temps in the low to mid-30s. Tomorrow, slight chance of rain, possibly snow in northwest Minnesota. Mostly cloudy with temps in the low to mid-40s. And Saturday, partly sunny, highs near 43.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The government shutdown is creating a lot of uncertainty and disruption for Native American and Alaska Native communities and for tribal organizations that administer federal programs. These include SNAP for food assistance and the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which subsidizes energy bills. Ben Malott, president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, told the Senate Indian Affairs Committee Wednesday that the prospect that both of these programs would run out of money just as winter begins puts some Alaskans in a life-threatening bind.
Without LIHEAP, without SNAP, our communities or tribal citizens will have to decide between fuel and food.
During the pandemic, the Federal Subsistence Board allowed emergency hunting to improve food security. Now with the government shut down, Malott says the Subsistence Board cannot even meet. More than 500 Indian Land School districts are feeling financial stress too. Carrie Bird, president of the National Indian Education Association, says federal impact aid provides half the budget for some schools, and the shutdown is interrupting the flow.
In South Dakota, Montana, and New Mexico, school districts are burning through reserves just to meet payroll.
Bird says Head Start programs will run low on money if the shutdown extends into November. Witnesses say many agency experts tribes normally turn to have lost their jobs. Pete Upton testified about the Trump administration's plan to abolish a fund at the Treasury Department called the Community Development Financial Institutions Fund. Upton runs the Native CDFI network. He says tribal communities are often in banking deserts.
Native CDFIs are typically the only financial institutions serving these communities, providing access to capital, credit, and financial education where no alternative exists.
Early in the shutdown, the Treasury Department fired the entire staff at the CDFI fund. With no one at the federal office to certify CDFIs, Upton says it's hard for community finance organizations to attract private sector investment. Senator Lisa Murkowski, chair of the Indian Affairs Committee, says tribes face enormous uncertainty as the stalemate in Congress nears the one-month mark.
We can't figure out the path forward right now on our spending bills, although I am a little bit more optimistic on that today.
She did not elaborate, but said earlier this week that senators are engaged in productive talks. The Navajo Nation has had four attorneys general in less than a year. And as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, one of them returns to that office amid a politically tense time in Window Rock, Arizona.
And we have a vote of 2 in favor, 19 opposed, with the speaker not voting. Main motion fails.
Colin Bradley was acting attorney general for less than 3 months, but the Navajo Nation Council wouldn't confirm him, forcing President Boo Nigrin to tap his own chief of staff, Chris Beecher, yet again.
My hope is to bring that stability for the rest of the administration and allow the Department of Justice to have one last leader for the end of this term.
Bradley penned a pair of opinions tackling decades-old Diné legal disputes. One ruled that blood quantum, a controversial way to determine tribal membership, violates the Navajo Bill of Rights. He also deemed the Diné Marriage Act discriminatory and to immediately repeal it. That 2005 law bars recognition of same-sex marriage. But there's a debate whether his writings are null and void. As for Beecher,
there's long-standing precedent that any of the opinions that you wish still stand.
Unless undone by the sitting attorney general. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver-resources. Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
By dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. When companies need a loan, traditionally they turn to a bank. But increasingly they are turning to financial firms that are not really banks, but do have a lot of cash. This is the private credit market. It has exploded in the past 15 years. It's now valued at around $2 trillion. Natasha Sarin is president of the Yale Budget Lab, and she argues that these private credit firms are making risky loans, so risky they have got her thinking about the 2008 financial crisis. Natasha Sarin, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you wrote a piece, this was for the New York Times, and the headline, which I loved, was, "How bad is finance's cockroach problem? We are about to find out." Unpack that for us. Who were the cockroaches in this scenario?
So the cockroach I can't take credit for, because it comes from Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, as he was commenting on something that many of us who aren't deep in the finance industry may have even missed over the course of the last many weeks, which is that two auto-related firms went bankrupt over the course of a few weeks in September. That in and of itself is not necessarily all that interesting. They're relatively small firms. But what is kind of interesting and pretty important is that it turns out that they had borrowed much more money in ways that were ultimately pretty opaque and kind of hidden, even from their own investors, than people had previously realized.
So we're not talking Ford. We're not talking GM. What is it that you see happening that has you so worried?
One piece that's interesting is about the way they were ultimately borrowing. And it turns out that they were borrowing in part from traditional banks and public markets, but they were also borrowing in part from private markets and from these private credit firms. And importantly, when they ultimately went bankrupt, it had to do with learning more about the fact that these firms had allegedly committed fraud by doing things like offering the same collateral to multiple people who lend it to them. And that type of opacity, such that the lenders themselves didn't even realize how much borrowing these two particular firms had done, is a feature of what you can see happening these days in private credit markets. But because of regulation that we did in the aftermath of the financial crisis, it is happening much less in public markets and much less in banks.
Okay, so we've mentioned the 2008 financial crisis a couple of times. What is it you see that feels the same as 2008? What is it you see that maybe is not parallel? Start with what's the same.
Yeah, and Andrew Bailey, who runs the Central Bank of England, said anyone watching these two particular bankruptcies, like, alarm bells should be going off if they were anywhere near the 2008 financial crisis. We are starting to see the same kind of slicing and dicing of literally everything. Think car loans, think leases on AI data centers, think bills that are owed from plastic surgery patients, literally everything, and turning it into allegedly relatively safe slices of financial securities. But the other pieces there too, we're also starting to see really significant lending, and it's happening very substantially in these private credit markets.
So how much are ordinary people at risk of being caught up in all this? 2008 was about a lot of things, but among it was ordinary people's mortgages. I know you have been thinking about 401ks potentially down the road being caught up in this private credit, the riskiness that you see.
Private credit, in some sense, when you hear the word private credit, you think private.
Right.
And so it sounds different to you than a bank or public markets. But the challenge is, where is private credit ultimately getting the dollars that are coming its way to invest? And those dollars are coming from things like pension funds. Those dollars are coming from things like private equity firms buying insurance companies. As a result, ordinary people's dollars are on the line just like they were in 2008.
So what can we do? As we see the train coming down the tracks, what can be done now by the government, by Congress, by the administration to try to prevent it from going off the rails?
Congress needs to think about ways in which to better regulate these markets. And we, as sort of consumers, need to do our own due diligence about the ways in which our dollars are ultimately exposed to potential risks down the road.
Lay the traps for the cockroaches to bring it home.
We'll do our best.
Natasha Saron, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
She is president of the Yale Budget Lab.
The paramilitary group fighting a civil war in Sudan has killed more than 460 patients and their companions at the last functioning hospital in the city of El Fasher. That's according to the World Health Organization. Kate Bartlett reports that it is one of the worst atrocities of Sudan's 2.5-year war, according to human rights groups. And a warning, listeners will hear gunshots in this piece.
Dr. Mohamed Faisal Al-Sheikh, a spokesperson for the Sudan Doctors Network, says there's only one word to describe the doctors who worked in El Fasher.
They are heroes, honestly. They really worked in a very difficult environment.
But that didn't stop them.
They had no any medical instruments. There's no any medicines. There's no electricity. And yet, with all dedication and commitment, they saved as much as they could of people's life.
But now, the Saudi maternity hospital is in ruins, filled with the bodies of patients executed by the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF. And the doctors have been taken captive.
We were horrified by reports of the tragic killings of more than 460 people, both patients and their companions, at the Saudi maternity hospital in El Fasher.
That's the UN Secretary General's spokesman, Stephane Dujarric, speaking on Wednesday about the massacre. The UN says health facilities, doctors and patients must be protected under international law. RSF leader General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo has pledged to investigate the allegations, but many doubt his sincerity. Aid organizations circulated a video that appears to have been filmed by the RSF themselves that shows their fighters walking through the hospital's wards, shooting anyone left alive. For over 2 years now, the RSF, made up of former Janjaweed fighters, has been fighting Sudan's army. 2 decades ago, the Janjaweed were accused of genocide in Darfur. Now, their successors are fighting for control of Sudan's rich resources. It's not the first time the RSF has targeted healthcare facilities. Most of Sudan's hospitals are either closed or in desperate condition. Now, those who've managed to flee Al Fasher are desperately seeking help.
Our teams are working 60 kilometers away in Tawila, where they're seeing people starting to arrive from El Fasher.
That's Doctors Without Borders International President Mohamed Javed Abdelmonem.
Among all the people arriving in Tawila, we're seeing very few adult men. Given the history of ethnically targeted violence in El Fasher, we are deeply concerned about the risk of a potential bloodbath.
For Dr. Al-Sheikh, his thoughts are with the abducted staff.
They were very dedicated, despite the difficulties that they are facing in their work, but they were very committed to their holy message.
For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. And we receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Now for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, a new cannabis safety campaign centers on young people in Minnesota. Then, a Twin Cities radio station announces a big milestone and a ceremony next month marking an important anniversary for Split Rock Lighthouse. I'm Gracie J. A new campaign from the Minnesota Department of Health is urging young people under 25 to be cannabis aware. The campaign educates youth about the risks of cannabis use, including reduced attention span, impaired memory, and dependence. Be Cannabis Aware combines science-based information with input from young people, offering families, educators, and communities tools to start open, judgment-free conversations about cannabis. Learn more and find downloadable resources at becannabisaware.org. Next, Amper's member station KMOJ announced the location of its new Forever Home in North Minneapolis. Catherine DeSalle was at the event and explains why the station is moving and the new opportunities that come with the move.
It's a celebration of vision, it's resilience, and a community that continues rising no matter what. If we can make it through COVID and not miss 1 hour of broadcasting, we can build this radio station.
That's KMLJ's general manager, Freddie Bell, speaking at a special ceremony in North Minneapolis to celebrate the spot where KMLJ's new Forever Home building will go. The station is being forced to move locations due to construction of the Blue Line light rail.
It's a home for the voices that deserve to be heard, not marginalized. It's a hub for our community to grow, to connect, and to thrive. It's all about broadcast excellence. And that's what we're trying to bring to you.
Bringing unity to the community. 89.9 KMOJ, the People's Station.
KMOJ derived from the Swahili word, umoja, meaning unity. So the station was named Kamoja. And you just broke it down and just say KMOJ.
That's Senate President Bobby Joe Champion, who says the state approved nearly $1 million to help KMOJ kick off its $17 million plan for their new North Minneapolis home.
KMOJ was vital for public service announcements, where and how to receive local resources from local agencies and churches. However, artists became instant neighborhood stars when they played over air on KMOJ.
Since 1976, KMOJ has been broadcasting news, information, and helping to popularize local musicians from Prince to the Sounds of Blackness and more.
FM 89.9 KMOJ, no doubt, ladies and gentlemen. Walter Q. Bear Banks Jr. got you on the afternoon drive and letting you know.
Afternoon Drive Time host, Walter Q. Bear Banks Jr.
It was 810 Fifth Avenue North, and that actually was two project housing houses that was connected together, and that's where the station was originated at physically.
The day's ceremony included an unveiling of blueprints of the new 10,000-square-foot building.
It's quite amazing to see the layout and the plans of the structure of the building itself and the different spaces and purposes for each individual room.
Morning show co-host Chantel Sings.
I love the fact that we are working towards making sure that we preserve something for the next generations to come. People that want to be in media in whatever way. It's not just going to be a radio station. It's going to be like a media center. So we'll have podcast spaces. We'll have spaces for people to come in and train.
KMLJ is working to have their new building operational by 2028. And say they're grateful for their listeners and the community support.
I love every last one of you. If nobody told you today, you are definitely loved. Walter Q. Bear Banks Jr. And 89.9 KMOJ. Y'all keep it right where it's at, where the listening is definitely good.
For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Well, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Split Rock Lighthouse is hosting a memorial beacon lighting on November 10th to mark the anniversary. The ceremony honors the 29 crew members of the Edmund Fitzgerald and others lost on Lake Superior. The Edmund Fitzgerald, a massive cargo ship, sank on November 10th, 1975, in Lake Superior.
The ceremony is free and open to the public, but you have to get tickets from the Minnesota Historical Society.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Toads have taken over the world. For real. This isn't some horror movie I'm talking about. This is actually happening, people. Don't freak out. But toads have found their way onto 6 out of the 7 continents. I guess the climate of Antarctica isn't great for amphibians. Anyway, toads originated in South America. So how did they end up dominating so much of the rest of the world? Well, a new study out this month tells us how. Christopher Raxworthy is a herpetologist and a curator at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He's also one of the study's co-authors. We spoke recently about how this slimy, chunky creature has made its way all around the world and why that is so important.
We don't know for certain, but there's two main hypotheses, two routes they could have done. The first is they could have gone through Antarctica, which is, you know, a wild idea. That's the one continent where we don't have toads now. Yeah. But 30 million years ago, the climate was a lot warmer, so the distances between land masses then would have been quite a bit closer. So they could have gone into Antarctica and then from Antarctica into southern Africa.
Cool.
But perhaps a more likely route is actually them rafting across the Atlantic Ocean.
And rafting? That
sounds, yeah, crazy, right? But
they built little rafts? No, come on, tell me
no,
how.
No, but if you ever have been in the tropics in a major rainstorm, you will see, you know, rivers just with huge amounts of water coming down them, banks of rivers slipping, yes. And trees and mats of vegetation being washed out to the oceans. And toads often live in rotten logs and in cavities, in mud banks. And so you could easily imagine, you know, rafts of vegetation getting washed out into the ocean. And toads are tough guys. They have thick skins. They're more resistant to dehydration. And so all you would need is ultimately one lucky group of toads on a mat of vegetation to get washed up on a beach in Africa, and they're on their way. The other thing about toads, though, that gave them an edge was they're highly toxic now. They have these big paratoid glands on their necks. That is actually an anti-predator device. And what we also established in our study is that this time of toad invasion is associated with these glands evolving.
Wow. Okay, well, as we mentioned, Antarctica right now doesn't have toads. Could we one day see toads living in one of the coldest places on Earth? Because you're telling me they have really thick skins. Maybe they're going to get thicker.
Well, there's two interesting things about that. So first of all, we actually have, believe or not, now found fossil amphibians from Antarctica, which, you know, document that warmer period in their history. And toads are still spreading and getting into the final corners of the world that they haven't invaded. So they're getting a help now with humans. Australia had no toads until the 1930s when they were introduced as a biological control. And in 2010, the Asian toad got into Madagascar, probably in a shipping container with a shipment of rice. And so they are expanding their range still to get to these, you know, remote corners of the world.
So maybe there are some people listening right now and thinking, why do I even care about these toads and why they ended up in my backyard? Come on. Why are these findings of this study so significant, Christopher?
Right. Well, I think toads in themselves are beautiful animals and worthy of study. If you look into an eye of a toad, it's like, oh, it's fantastic.
But really? Oh, you connect with the toad's eyes.
If you're not convinced by that, then if you talk to gardeners, they'll always refer to toads as the gardener's friend. They eat slugs and pests. But I think also fundamentally, understanding about the relationships between different species, for example, predators and prey, and also understanding about what traits of species actually mean that they're successful, that they produce more species, even understanding the process of speciation, we can learn all of these different processes from toads.
Well, Christopher, you have inspired me to look straight into a toad's eyes the next time I see a toad.
They're wonderful.
Christopher Raxworthy, curator of herpetology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Thank you so much. This was so fun.
Thank you.
Think of Tyrannosaurus Rex, a fearsome dinosaur and the top predator stalking the late Cretaceous. Well, a new discovery suggests T-Rex likely shared its dominion with another Tyrannosaurus species. The king had company. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
We start with Clayton Phipps.
I'm a rancher and a cowboy and a dinosaur hunter.
Whose friend had found an exposed pelvis and femur at the bottom of a canyon in eastern Montana. The bones belonged to a stunning triceratops. Then, after excavating for about 2 weeks, there in the dug-up sand, Phipps spotted something the color of chocolate, a claw. But triceratops didn't have claws.
I'm like, what? I start brushing and all of a sudden this arm starts to appear and part of the leg. Oh man, my hat went in the air about 200 feet. Because I was like, no way, there's another dinosaur in here.
This was a bipedal carnivorous tyrannosaur entwined with the triceratops.
Just laying like they died.
Phipps sold the fossils to the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, where Lindsay Zano is head of paleontology.
It's one of the most incredible specimens from the late Cretaceous in North America I've ever seen.
Zano and the museum built an entire wing around the dueling dinosaurs to house a live-action research experience.
It's the only place in the world where you get to enter the working paleo lab and talk to the scientific team.
Like many of her colleagues, Zano started out thinking the carnivorous dinosaur was a juvenile T-Rex, perhaps the most complete teenage tyrannosaur ever found.
But as soon as we started actually studying this specimen, we realized there were a lot of red flags.
One red flag was the arm bones, which were unlike T-Rex's puny appendages.
These are powerful arms with large claws, large hands.
The animal had fewer tail vertebrae than T-Rex and more teeth.
But maybe the most damning thing that we did was we were able to figure out that our animal is not a juvenile at all.
By slicing through the limb bones to examine the growth rings, Zano and her colleagues found this animal was done growing when it died. It all pointed to one conclusion, she says. This was no teen T-Rex. This was a different tyrannosaur species whose existence was long dismissed by most paleontologists. This was a fully grown Nanotyrannus lancensis.
A small, slender pursuit predator that could run under the legs of a T-Rex. This is an animal that's using its arms to hunt prey. Tyrannosaurus rex is an animal that's a mouth on legs.
For years, most researchers believed there was just one tyrannosaur, Rex. This work dethrones the king. There were other tyrannosaurs holding court.
It tells us that these end Cretaceous ecosystems were flourishing before the asteroid struck.
The findings appear in the journal Nature. Thomas Holtz is a paleontologist at the University of Maryland who wasn't involved in the study. He welcomes the broader picture of tyrannosaur diversity.
I always said, with sufficient evidence, I'd be happy to embrace it, and now I can. But we'll see if it lasts. As I like to point out, taxonomy is not permanent.
The study opens up numerous research avenues about the varied biologies and behaviors of what appears to be a growing group of tyrannosaurs. Lindsay Zano again.
This is why I love science. What I'm most thrilled about is how much we stand to learn by recognizing that we got it wrong the first time.
For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features with Begonia, starring Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, now playing in select theaters everywhere tomorrow. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography, Kauffman.org. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. And it is Member Appreciation Week here at KXE KBXE now through November 1st, and we've got a couple events coming up these next couple days. Tomorrow, Trick or Treat. Swing by KXE in Grand Rapids or KBXE in Bemidji to say boo while we hand out candy during business hours. And a special Kids Green Cheese airs Saturday, November 1st from 6 to 7 p.m. with Mike Spry and youngsters Mia and Alex. And visit the Screamatorium at Chair in downtown Virginia now through November 1st from 6 to 10 each evening. Those in elementary school must be accompanied by an adult. A tamer version will be offered to younger kids on Halloween from 4 to 6. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
China policy is the president's policy. He drives.